This interview with Coleman Gronseth is part of the Pioneers on Tape program sponsored by the Leland Township Library. Its purpose is to make available to its public a series of recorded tapes by senior citizens who have lived in the area for many years. By recording this oral history, we hope to preserve the traditions, events, and color of our area.
Mr. Gronseth, what were your parents' names?
Conrad and Verna. My mother had, however, a nickname that she carried from early childhood, which was Dutch, referring to her German background and her obstinacy in life.
What was her maiden name?
Heimforth. She was born and raised in Elmwood Township on a farm setting that my grandfather and great-grandfather had shared.
Is the farm still in existence today?
Yes, it is. Still held in family members are operating it. They have, incidentally, a very large dairy farm, as well as cherry. And it was of interest to me to look back in the geography books that I had when I was in school at Sutton's Bay, and in the back of geography books at that time, you had a special supplement for Michigan. And three of the five pictures in agriculture or farming in Michigan were taken off of my grandfather's farm. I have a copy of that text somewhere in my library at home.
How long ago did your relatives come to the Sutton's Bay area?
Into the Sutton's Bay area was my father's people. They were Norwegian immigrants, both grandfather and grandmother. They arrived in Michigan and lived first in Bay City, and the year of that was 1881, and then moved to Sutton's Bay in the year of 1886.
Can you tell us when and where you were born?
I was born in Sutton's Bay, and the date distinguishes itself not on any calendar, but in my own memory, June 10th, 1921.
Who delivered you?
There was a doctor in residence in Sutton's Bay, a Dr. Slepica, and he had limited practice that subsequently was taken over by a Dr. Kernkamp, whom I remember quite well, and a Dr. Jones, then Dr. Ellis, and Dr. Bolin.
Were you born in your house?
I was born in my grandparents' home, which is on St. Mary's Street, one block up from the St. Joseph, or the main business street of Sutton's Bay.
Do you have any brothers or sisters?
Well, I was such perfect design, Ed, that my parents stopped production at that point. The answer is no. I was an only child.
Could you tell us, just for the record, what your age is right now?
Yes. I am one day short of being 62.
What was your family life like when you were growing up?
I suspect, like a great deal of family lives at that time, my parents had a very difficult struggle. My father opened a small shoe store, or maintained a small shoe store that my grandfather had established. And a very unusual period, they started this in 1920 in the little community of Sutton's Bay. Prior to making the decision to come back home, my grandfather's shoe store was the only place at which shoes could be purchased in the community. And within a year after my parents set up shop, six other shoe stocks operated, usually out of the general type store that you had that would sell clothing, fencing, groceries, take in butter, eggs, and milk. And it was quite a struggle for my parents to survive. It remained that way right on up through the time of their retirement.
Where was the shoe store located, and is the building still around today?
The building is around. It represents the second building that the family had as a place of business. The first building that my grandfather built was located on the site where subsequently he built his home and the home in which I was born. He built a second store about 1902 or 3, and then moved that to the location next door to the Hose House in Sutton's Bay, which until just 3-4 years ago was the fire station. And it's right on the corner of St. Joseph in the middle of the business district. Currently, there is a business in that building of architectural antiques.
What were your chores as a youngster?
It wasn't a matter of chores, Stephanie. It was slavery. I really did work a great deal. One of the main chores in the winter, of course, was shoveling snow. And I just have no idea how many thousands to tens of thousands of tons of snow that I must have moved. The highway department at that time, when they did plow, it was just one track going north and one track going south. And our business was located on a corner which made an exaggerated parking area. So my responsibility was not only to shovel so hopefully a customer would have a place to park, but to remove the snow. There's a little stream that runs through the middle of Sutton's Bay, and I would hand carry the snow, dump it into the stream so that the water would dissolve and carry it away, and that was a lengthy process. In addition to that, the village, about the time I got strong enough to move a lot of snow, was the middle of the Depression, and the village wouldn't shovel out the fire station, so that was added to my shoveling. And then next door, where the telephone office had its business, was operated by Clara Lund, unmarried, no children, no slaves such as me, so my shoveling extended to there as a courtesy because they were friends of my parents. And I can recall my parents encouraging me to play basketball when I was in high school, but the snow was always there, and many nights come back from a basketball game at 11 o'clock Friday. Saturday was considered to be the important business day, and I'd start shoveling snow 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, and oftentimes shoveled until 4 or 5 in the morning, so that that area of the street would be clear.
You mentioned basketball. Who did you play against? What other schools were there to play against?
You had more schools in the county. For example, there was a high school at Maple City, and of course Northport, Leland, St. Mary's were on our schedule. Traverse City had Class A status and of course had far better talent to draw on, but they had a very good junior varsity team. That would be on our schedule. We went over to Rapid City, to Williamsburg, down to Kingsley. Quite interesting on Traverse City, Governor Milliken was not good enough to make the varsity, but he was a standout on the JV. And Governor and I jumped center against each other for a couple of years. And, of course, that was back when basketball was not as refined and sophisticated as today. You had a center jump after each basket was made instead of the out of bounds. And I don't recall in 2 years of jumping center that I lost a jump to anyone, including the governor. But that's about the only thing that I got a jump on in that time of life.
Who was on the basketball team with you?
Well, there was quite a number of names that flood my memory on that. In my junior year, there was Bob Roofley, and Owen Bailey, Glenn Thomas, Myself, of course, and then we had to bow and dip to freshman level. Bill Stratton, Melvin Gain, Jerry Walters, Jack Sind was for a while. These are names that are a part of Sutton's Bay School.
Where was the school that you went to?
School is the cobblestone building that's also up on the north end of St. Mary's. It housed a kindergarten through 12th grade, and I attended all 13 grades at that school. The was rather interesting to attend that school because two uncles of mine had worked on that during the time of its construction, which was about 1908, 1909, and 10.
As a student in one of your classes, you frequently tell us, or you used to anyways, about how you read every book in the library at school. Could you elaborate on
yeah,
that?
That is true. I did enjoy reading. Living next door to the fire station, as we did, because our apartment or family home was upstairs above our store, there was a library upstairs in the hose house. And I remember starting reading and was very proud to have a library card. When I went into the junior high, seventh grade at the high school, we had a study hall that was the entire north end of the second floor. That was subsequently divided to make another classroom in there. But it was an incentive to sit there as a seventh and eighth grader and see high school students reading books. And our little library was for the high school was held underneath a staircase in the basement area of the school. And I just simply said that it would be my goal to read every book in the library before I left school. And the thing, of course, that is amusing in that is, first of all, how naive a person can be, and secondly, how small a library can be, because there, I think the count was that I had, and I kept cards on them, I believe was 353 books. And I did manage that before my senior year was out, and then decided, I chuckled to myself today, I decided I'd read the encyclopedia, and I got down through K of Compton's before I graduated, and that, of course, doesn't mean I understood what I read, but I manfully went through page by page of everything that they had to offer.
How many kids did you graduate with?
There were 13 in my graduating class. Incidentally, interesting one on that. Starting out in the ninth grade, and this was at a period when you had country schools, which would usually have kindergarten through eighth grade, so you would be receiving students that were new to you in the ninth grade. There were 39 in my freshman class, so the for a variety of reasons, you can see that we used to have significant dropping out of school as soon as a person hit the age then of 14, and then that was advanced to 16. But 13 of us managed to survive.
Did you have any Indians in your school from Shelbytown?
I did not have Indians in school as classmates. I did, when I returned to teaching, in 1946, and when I got out of the Army, and we had several Indian students from Peshawetown. And one particularly that I enjoy and visit with today is Melvin Jingway, who works for the Postal Department in East Lansing.
To get back to your house that you lived in, what was your favorite place in that house?
My favorite place was a window off of the bedroom that I had. We had a low steam radiator there that had a little cover cap on it that looked out over into what is yet today a village park and a stream. And in this village park, we had a waterfall and a water wheel. And I just enjoyed many, many hours of reading, and I tried to write poetry, never saved anything because I couldn't. But the inspiration was there. A warm summer afternoon, you get a break and you'd hear the water wheel just slap, 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 slap. It was very pleasant. That was a favorite.
Did you have indoor plumbing in your house?
Oh, yes. Yes, we did. But we also had the remnants of the outhouse. The outhouse was functional. It stood in the behind the store, as it did in most every street. And ours was built of sufficient quality that it defied probably 30 to 40 years of Halloween pranksters. It was just simply torn down. It never did get tipped over.
Speaking of Halloween, what did you do when you were a boy on Halloween? Are they as reckless and destructive as they are today?
My recollection of that would be as a group more destructive than I see today. Personally, I was accused at the tender age of 10 or 11 of a Halloween prank in town that I was not even remotely associated with. And my parents were more prone to accept the accusation or the truth of the accuser than they were their son. And so I was basically forbidden to get out on Halloween.
What did you, or what were you accused of?
Well, I was accused of using wax on windows and breaking a window in a residence up at the other end of town. And that just was not my area. And because my parents had a store with plate glass windows, it was always my task to clean the windows off after Halloween. And that soaping or waxing a window just was not my style to begin with because I knew how much work it was.
Did people pass out candy on
Halloween? No. People passed out rock salt from a 12-gauge shotgun on occasion, but that was not thing that was a fun thing for little kids. Halloween often would have a group of men in their 20s and 30s that would aid and abet the imagination of the late teenagers. There was a lot of destructive evidence after Halloween.
What did you do in your spare time for recreation?
Well, basketball was one, fishing another. I can remember I built a lot of kites, and we had the hill up behind the school, which in that period was barren, so that it made excellent kite flying hill. And I was kind of a leader in that activity in my junior high days. I'd sometimes have three or four kites in the air. And in one way was the envy, because I had a source of very strong, lightweight thread, with my dad having a shoe shop, and I used to use spools of the high-quality linen thread that we used in the stitchers to sew on soles on shoes. But I could generally get a kite farther out than anybody else in town because I had the weight advantage on them. I was also a nut. I like to hike back up over the hills and take something in the way of a picnic. And anyone that knows of my appetite knows that generally food went with me. But I'd try to get different people to join me, but very often would be hiking alone. And I can remember hiking across to Lake Lillino and stay there. I like fishing. I liked ice fishing a great deal. And managed to build a shanty and did a lot of ice fishing through several of the winters in the 1930s were very severe, and we had good ice on the bay, and we also had good fishing.
Were there woods as you've got today? Were the woods as big and as plentiful as they are today?
No, wood timber growth or cover today is far more extensive than it was then. Most of the county, that would be true. The timber was really stripped, and there were many more farms than you see today. farms used to be 40 acres, even 20-acre farms. And each of the farmsteads would have a home and a family. So that it interests me to drive over and, again, hike over some of the hills around there, which I have done in the past several years, and see that there is substantial second growth, particularly a hardwood coming back in place. You know, I can think of an interesting one that, as a matter of survival and things that occur, thinking of ice on the bay, and it must have been about the winter of 1934 or 5, a fellow that lived in the north end of town, Elmer Duster, had an ice boat. Now, it was not one of these sleek things that we see today. It was a very heavy sapling frame built in the form of a T, and they had quite a large platform on the tiller or stern, and then two outboard platforms on each of the runners. And we had just beautiful, what we used to call glass ice on almost the entire bay, and a strong south wind sometime in early March, I'd guess, because the spring breakup was just about on. But the Elmer invited a bunch of us to go for a ride, and I was riding on the left or port side, and we headed north out the bay, not realizing that this strong wind had broken the ice away beyond the tip of Stony Point, or then called Larson's Point. And we hit the spot where we could see, and we called to Elmer to tell him to turn the tiller, come about, and the runners were just rounded reinforcing rod and wouldn't bite into that glass ice. And he finally got that thing around, and I was riding to the outside of the port platform and could have reached down and picked up a handful of water in the what would be the middle of the bay. We were just a matter of inches from dumping 10 or 11 of us into the bay, and I'm sure there'd have been a poor chance of survival of any of us had that happened. We beached the thing over on Stony Point and walked home, every one of us scared to death.
Just about where Vic Stimel
just was. About on Vic Stimel's property today, that is correct. That thing, that ice boat, I think, finally rotted in that position. I don't think anybody went after it.
Did you ever get to the neighboring towns?
Not often. Neighboring towns were... That represented getting into a car to visit and know kids in different towns. That seldom happened. Northport and Leland were considered Snobsville at that time because generally the people in Northport, the year-round residents in Northport and Leland had better jobs. Was related to the people who had summer homes up here, and there were more jobs available. And summertime, as a kid, I basically had work at home. You didn't have time to just go screw around very often.
Did you go to movies in Sutton's Bay? And when was the Bay Theater built?
Well, the Bay Theater was built as a theater after World War II. But we had a theater called the Colonial Theater, which today houses an antique shop. It's located on Broadway between St. Mary's and St. Joseph Avenue. And that was run by the man that had the print shop for the Sutton's Bay Courier, a weekly paper. His name was K. Gus Smerry. And it was a silent film at first, and K. Gus had the... first attempt at a talkie, which was a large record turntable. Interesting, there used to be variances in the speed of the turntable, so once in a while you'd have to get out and spin it a little faster, then the voice would get ahead of the characters on the screen, or the opposite would be true, but we thought it was rather remarkable to have that. The big thing, I think, was what we used to call the free movies. There would be a number of merchants that would pay for slide advertising, and it was an outdoor movie. held in the Township Park up diagonally across from St. Michael's Church, and also up on the old fairgrounds. And we'd have crowds that would come in where there would be, on a nice evening when there wasn't a storm, there'd be probably 800 to 1,000 people that would come to the free movie. Sutton's Bay had a preferred night. It was Sunday night. And then this man that operated this mobile unit would then travel to other communities in the greater Grand Traverse area. He had almost a seven-night-a-week schedule during the summer. And that was basically the movie. I seldom went to Traverse City. It was an extraordinary treat to go to the then Lyric Theater. And I only recall in my childhood of maybe seeing six or eight film in Traverse City. It cost too much. I think it was 10 cents or maybe 15 cents. Just didn't have the money.
When you would go into Traverse City, would you ride the train?
No, I have ridden a train to Traverse City and ridden a train to the Heimferth Crossing, which was my grandparents' farm, both ways, but generally would go by car on what we called Old M-22, which today is 633. It's the street that goes out past the high school at Sutton's Bay.
Where was Heimferth Crossing? Where is it located?
Heimferth Crossing is located west of 633 or Old M-22, about a mile west of it on Lakeview Road.
How long?
There are names such as Britton and Warner that were other families on that crossing corner.
How long did it take you to get to Travers on the train?
Well, back then the trackage was in much better condition. The train would travel about 40 miles an hour, and of course it had the most direct route into Travers. I think the trackage from Sutton's Bay to Traverse City at that time was in the neighborhood of 13 miles. And so you would translate that you were into Traverse in about 20 to 25 minutes.
Where was the train station in Traverse?
The station is where Michigan National Bank now has, I think, its main office in Traverse City. It's up off of Railroad Avenue and 8th Avenue. But you could get off at intermediate points as you came into town. There used to be a depot down near where Clinch Park is also. That was the Pennsylvania Depot, and they had accommodations with the old M&NE. That was a train that came out of Sutton's Bay, and M&NE stood for Manistee and Northeastern, and the home office of that railroad was in Manistee itself.
What were some of your other jobs while you were in high school?
Well, I have two that occupied me, and one of them occupied a lot of people. You hand-picked cherries back then. And I first started picking cherries for Gust or August Barley, who had a small orchard up near where the new Sutton's Bay High School is now located. And then after I gained a little experience, I picked for O.L. Bailey, Owen Bailey's father, Otto, who had an orchard up behind the Emmanuel Lutheran Church. But the best picking that I had was for Doosters, who had an orchard on the north end of town. And I think it was the summer of 1940 that I believe I set a record. At least I've not heard of anyone that picked as many cherries. We picked into wooden boxes called lugs, and on one day, which I said I was going to try to set a record, and I started really before daybreak. It was just barely beginning to be daylight, and picked into the darkness of that evening, and I got 52 lugs, and that represented just a tremendous amount of effort. The other job that I had, wanting to go to college and having no money, I had acquired a savings of about $65, and my parents encouraged me to buy a little 6x8 roadside stand, which we located by the side of our store, and I ended up having a little ice cream place, pop, candy, cigarettes, hot dogs, hamburgers, and popcorn. And that was an excellent business. And I would run it from Memorial Weekend into the weekend of Labor Day, and recall being very proud the summer of 42, the last year that I operated it, I had a net profit of $2,700. Now, this was in a depression in the north, and I just have to say I had the privilege of getting ice cream when there was sugar shortage, because I'd been in business before World War II started and bought from Max Bauer's in Traverse City. And old John Max Bauer just honestly respected a kid that would put in the hours I did. And I used to open it around 9 o'clock in the morning, and many days had it open 24 hours. It was peculiar in the summer with all the cherry pickers. There would oftentimes be business right on through the wee hours of the morning, and then people who would want a hamburger to have for breakfast before they started picking cherries again.